Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Companion. I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. Great to see you. We're coming up on this, the 341st day of the year. That's only 21 days left, folks. But there's great things happening this time of year. The winter solstice is on us. 14 days until the winter solstice. That's amazing. The significance of the solstice shouldn't be lost to anybody. In the Northern Hemisphere, we celebrate it in December, and the Southern in June. Yeah. So why the big deal? Why the sensation about it? It's been, as you can imagine, the time when the ancient period that marked the return of the sun. Return of the sun meant life, because the crops would begin growing again. It's the astronomical phenomenon, marks the shortest day and the longest night of the year. So, you know, out of the darkness comes light. And then it's not just a bumper sticker. It's more evident at the higher latitudes, but this is the time of the year when the sun, when the earth follows its orbit around the sun, and the same hemisphere that faced away from the sun experiencing winter will, in half a year, will face toward the sun and experience summer. So the two hemispheres face opposite directions along the planetary pole. So as one hemisphere experiences winter, the other gets summer. And life goes on as it always has until what we have. We only have, is it, now correct me here, 350 billion more years for our star before it eventually expires, as all stars do. And there you have it. You know, where will we be? Following an obscure spaceship to another planet? Well, we're going to have to find not another planet, but another star. But oh my, have you noticed? There's billions and billions, as Carl Sagan would have reminded us, billions and billions in the universes. And how many universes out there? Billions and billions. Possibilities are enormous. Let's presume that in the meantime, while we are here as stewards of this planet, if we want to call ourselves that, that we will use our wisdom to conduct ourselves in a cordial, a forthright manner, that knowing that the end is coming, I don't think there's any need to hasten it. There's an inevitability of the seasons come and go, and so do you and I. But we're an interesting little animal right now because we have consciousness, we're sensing, we understand and realize that we exist. And perhaps there are other animals that do, but we haven't found out how to communicate with them just yet. My goodness, we're having difficulty communicating with ourselves in our own lodges. So, you know, we sharpen our skills. Today, I would think that if Plato looked out on the masses that, at the jury that eventually found him guilty, what was the size of his jury? About 200, 300 people? In a space that was so large that you had to scream to be heard, where fights and quarrels broke out, where it's entirely possible that his responses to any of the questions put to him weren't heard by the majority of the people around, more majority of people on the jury. And remember, the jury was the first in line, the first 200 or 300. I can't remember right now how many were exactly, but I think it was in that ballpark. So, and remember, the wars of Athens had already passed. All the brilliant statisticians were dead. So what were you left with? At the best of times, we were left with the people that decided that one of the most significant philosophers of humanity should be put to death. And then within 10 years of executing the man, and he even tried to rid his nation-state Athens of that responsibility by doing it himself. 10 years on, they were recanted, realized the error of the way, and were building statues to the man. But the point is, would that be any different? I'm going to declare that if Plato was sitting here today, accused of such nefarious suggestions as misleading, interrupting the religious training and culture of the country, that he would have found the jury would today be better educated. Are we still prone to that emotional hysteria? Well, my goodness, yes. We're seeing now the world seems to be distracted by the murder of young men in the United States by those who we assign a great deal of responsibility and train to kill, if they decide that it's necessary, and now we have to clean up the mess because those darn little iPhones, everything's being recorded, and we're seeing what's been really going on for a long, long time that we often suspected. The fantasy is always better than the reality. So the harsh reality is a bit of a mess that needs to be sorted and fixed. And it ain't going to go away. Either we fix it now or we fix it 10 years or 20 or 50 or 100 years from now. But things need to be fixed. And pointing fingers and blaming, you think it's never really got help us get anywhere, but it's not likely to make that change in the future. Here, I've got an interesting program agenda for today. And I want to talk about inspiration. And as you know, I headed this one up as Eyes on Inspiration. I want to talk to you about, I've been talking to you about the secrets of masonry being not only an emotional experience, but the nature of the emotional experience. I want to talk to you today about where masonry is. It isn't a corporation, although it has to run as has business elements. It has it's a huge bureaucracy. It's layers of bureaucracy. It's layers of authority. Decisions have to be made. Some of those decisions, as you can imagine, of necessity and constitutionally are democratic. There's a democracy, and then there's democracy. So if we want to take a look at what's happened to an order in existence for 300 years, yes, it's changed over that time. You be the person that determines whether it's changed for the better or not by the judgment that will flow about your behavior and your contribution. A little stark reality here, and you know that I love the holiday season, and it's a period for reflection, renewal. It's a good time to be alive anywhere in the world except where you are suffering. And then you have to, it's not a good time, it's a hard time when you're suffering. Whether you're the a great majority of children in Canada go to bed hungry, wake up hungry, and go to school hungry. We middle class don't exactly care about that. The three or four generations of sort of an ersatz genocide with our native people is something that's really hard for us to accept. It is the stain on our cultural conscience, and nobody wants that stain. I think most nations can declare, most great nations, somewhere in their background can declare that they have had to learn by their tragic mistakes, and that is one of ours. I remember back in about 2000 or 2001 when Bill Clinton was saying, oh, there's advances in genetics, and we're going to find that the geneticists are going to allow us to find cures for Alzheimer's disease, for cancer, Parkinson's. So today, you know, 2014, not so much. That was a period when we were ready to clamor that there was a genetic indicator for everything that we do. Genetic indicator for a murder. Genetic indicator for being hit by lightning. Oh, my, must have been, because more men are hit by lightning than women. Statistics. It's not the statistics, the numbers don't lie. It's that we're a bit daffy about what we make of them. And as usual, anything we do in haste rarely works. So this is the little example of how we've sort of moved ahead, but it's our awareness and our conscious, collective consciousness. Thank you, Carl Jung, even though you were a little bit of a whack job at the end of it, but thank you for helping us think about this collective pool of information that is out there. All the little minds as little tiny computers. You put us all together, we have tremendous computing capacity. What are we doing with it? Well, let's take a look and see what Freemasonry has done with it. Participating in Masonry is more honest than most other obligations in life. But you have to want it. You have to want to be one. The Lost Boys join because they're bored or see an opportunity to mine the contacts for profit. They must be terribly disappointed. During the First World War, the world learned it was possible to gain support for an unpopular idea by using propaganda. All sides used it. When it was us, we called it education and information. When it's the enemy, it's called propaganda. Truth is, it's all the same. Someone believes people are stupid and can be led to support something they don't even understand. 100 years later, we have made this all so polite. Public relations or spin doctoring or media re-imaging, it's all the same. Those damned Masons. They're expected to pursue truth wherever it is to be found. Truth hurts. Truth is power. Truth is love. Slice it any way you want. Finding truth comes at a price. It is admitting to yourself what you don't admit to others. It is the unassailable starting point for improvement. So today, we talk about the things that inspire. Are you thinking it will not go well in your lodge? Silly, of course it won't. But it would be harmful to our harmony to point out those who are content with simple things. The titles, the ornaments, the distinctions, idle parade. Who are we to think they don't belong? We have the freedom to think for ourselves. We can talk, even though we have nothing useful to say, but enjoy the sound of our own voice. Babies know how to tune that out, and so do grown men. Life is full of lost opportunity. When insightful men gather in large groups, it is an enticing, enriching experience. So go out and find your group. Don't pretend and don't become miserable because of the thoughtless sod sitting beside you. No, it's not a matter of judgment, it's a matter of definition. They are scattered throughout the lodges of Ontario and beyond, they being like-minded men. humble men, not looking for sensationalism, but neither are they afraid to subjugate to promote their own thinking. Or are they? You see, those men are just like you. They're looking for that enriched conversation, not tedious and not boring and certainly not preachy. Now, are you all sitting down in your big, comfortable, overstuffed chair? I know, driving to work in your great big SUV with the four ways on and you're, driving 60 in an 80 zone and leaning forward, both hands in the proper 10 and 2 position. Here, a little bit of a news blast. All those guys are out there just like you, and they're looking for you just like you're looking for them. We can, one day masonry will figure this out. We can inspire people to think, but we cannot make them think the way we want them to think. Now reconcile that with the notion of propaganda. And the question, somebody believes people are stupid and they can be led into something even though they don't understand it. Oh my goodness, was that the thinking that led up to the, that happened at the start of the First World War? Oh my goodness, it certainly was. Did we learn from this? Once upon a time, masonry operated, and we know from our own sense of history that literacy was not as widespread as it is today. Here, rather than the poor clamoring to be educated, knowing that that's their necessary tools to a better life, except when you're coming from a disadvantaged position where you have the experience of knowing that all of the people that are well-educated are doing much better than you, come to Canada, come to the shores, and are met with this wall of indifference where the hustle, the cool, the pretend, the front, the charade is all more important than the education. The criticism, the indifference, all more important than the opportunity. Masonry in the 21st century now thrives on literacy. I'm thinking in my utopian lodge, I probably would think twice about on my ballot if I knew that the man was not interested, not a student at all in anything, and would probably park himself at the end of a lodge bench until he began to realize that everybody in the room would listen to him if he stood up to speak. And oh my goodness, that's never happened before. And if anything isn't the catalyst for catastrophe, that's it. Why would I do that? Why would I do that to him? Put him in the situation where doesn't have the potential. Oh, you mean because mean to say? Really? What's harsh? Is it the truth? You decide. Masonic Companion's with you. I'm not here to chew up everything into pablum and pass it out to you. Make you think a little bit. Doesn't mean that anything you hear is the way the world should be. It's just think about it. Think about it a little bit. What's happening with Masonic literacy is something that we're going to try and attack. We're going to try and tackle this one, take this on, the challenge. There's so many inspiring stories through history about men who have started off from very meager means and made something of it themselves and educated themselves and actually made a pretty serious contribution. And that group includes twits. Twits, people born to privilege, who from the time they were born didn't have a map. Expectations were so low because they were entitled. So they didn't really have to make a contribution. Well, those boys, a lot of those boys, didn't accept the premise that they were useless, that they didn't make a contribution, that they could live on the welfare of their family. Well, today we've replaced that with the welfare state. Still, the uselessness remains the same. Until a man wakes up, till he comes to realize that he can. Any sense of entitlement is not a barrier. It's a state of mind. A lot of men, you and I know them. Oh, let's just pick a couple. Isaac Newton, there you go. Thorsten Veblen, you know. People that came from a position of entitlement in some ways and decided that the enrichment of their own mind was absolutely necessary. Amen to that. I think everybody in their up to their own capacity is owed that much out of a life. Whether they're taught by their tradesmen in the family, or the women of the family, how to do something very well. Whether they're taught to knock on the door of a college or university. Or they learn to handle tools and learn that they have a capability of precision. Or they are fortunate enough to be artistic, to be able to put oil to canvas or pen to paper, or build great ideas into cathedrals. The dreamers, the philosophers, the mathematicians, we need them all. And at no point in life should we ever accept good enough. At no point. Even on your last, as you draw your last breath, it's not good enough. Be curious. Look around. What else is going on? And what else, in some small way, can you apply to your own development? And that's what we begin to know as a Masonic philosophy, a work that's never done. A man who is always in a constant state of apprenticeship, always looking to be taught more. And not only that, but is ready through his own behavior to demonstrate that lifestyle and way of thinking to people around him. Now, if that doesn't provide an element of contentment, then that you're pretty messed up. You mean there's messed up people in the world? Yeah, unfortunately. And some of it is we know. We know this. Gentlemen, we know this. We're often our own worst enemy. So stop overthinking is the message. Get out of our own heads. The satisfaction is doing things for other people. You want to settle the mind and keep the mind in that state of karma, you do for other people. That's one of the best parts of Masonry, isn't it? Sure it is. How are we doing with the history? Are you comfortable with the way we're moving along? Thank you for the support and the kind words that have been going around about the program. I think that's great. It's just what we've wanted. We're coming up to the Christmas season. And I need to share, I want everybody to experience Christmas in a Christian culture. That's what we live in. Wherever you've come from, Think of this. Think of you walking into the courts of the Mongols in the 14th century there, and you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim. All right. So you walk into the courts, and what do you find? Are you being repressed? Not at all. You'll find a curiosity, and you'll find the Khan wants you to teach his generals everything about your faith, everything, so that he can examine and compare and contrast. Yours is a different way, a different, perhaps, a different truth. A new idea, perhaps, or an extrapolation of an idea that's already present. Well, this is how great men learn. Not to be panicky and weak-kneed and kill off new ideas. That's the funny, ironic sadness of the world, isn't it? The idiocy of trying to kill an idea. You really can't. You can kill people. But can't kill a good idea. Or did I say a good idea? Don't think that, oh, that means all the bad ideas can't be killed. Qualify that. At the end of the day, good always prevails. There is no overt evidence of any form of utopian vision in the world of the medieval operative Mason. Although you've heard me talk about that, I've done a little paper on my Utopian Lodge, and I'll share that with you in a week or so as we come up to the Christmas holidays. But sit back and experience the best of what we have. If you just don't be distracted by the marketplace. The shills have always been out pulling on our sleeve. Sir, come and look at my goods and wares. I'll give you a good deal. Buy my buns. Buy my leather. Buy my trousers. Buy my shoes. Buy my gloves. Here's a hanky for your lady, sir. That's never stopped. The marketplace has become more organized. And now we don't have to go out and necessarily search for things. The marketplaces are huge, and we can find just about anything. If we go to New York City, we are said to find anything. But in the meantime, the marketplaces are around us. We let them into our homes through media. You know, since the 40s and 50s, television came into our home, and it's really sort of come full circle. It's gone from being something that was amazing to something that's annoying. And, you know, people are turning away from it in droves. I don't mean the people, the old boys and girls out there. Some of them are figuring it out. But the younger generations are using the internet and downloading and pulling in what they want when they want it. But the marketplace still is very aggressive and intrudes. So we're bombarded with messages, solicitation. Buy this, save this, and you know it's snake oil salesmen. It's all snake oil sales. You know, caveat emptor. The honesty of ads, come on. You know that there's spin. Why is there spin in a country, the constitutionally governed by the right of law? It's because it's always been the marketplace. It was there before these rights were entrenched. And so the law of the marketplace prevails still to this day. So be careful. But you can turn that off. That's not what the holidays are about. That's not what joy is about. That's not what Christmas is about as a Christian. It's not. It's not corny. It's something beautiful. It's something that this is time of year that confronts the fact that we have not really trained our children very well. We haven't. We've lowered the expectations. You know, we have. Collectively, in our communities, we tolerate hunger that we wouldn't have done. Our great-grandfathers wouldn't have tolerated it. there is an abundance. We can share. We should share. Our governments are not. We don't control them. There seem to be. They have a great struggle with the wishes, serving the wishes of the people. Here, the wish of the people in this time of year is to celebrate and to open up doors to share that celebration with other people from all nations and all beliefs, and to be curious to share the ideas about those beliefs as we move forward. They're all good. You're a good person. You have your beliefs, and bless you. That's a Christian culture. You don't have to be laboring like George Bush about axes of evil and that kind of stupidity. That's just stupid. But if you have the mind of a medieval man, look out the window that the world is in the 21st century, and it's pretty darn good. So if you wonder, you have to wonder, are we silly old men? Are we silly men clamoring for this sense of utopia that really doesn't exist? Really. You know, we want things done a particular prescribed way. Does it really exist, or is it utopian thinking? You know, substandard ritual that where we praise everybody. That's perfect. That's wonderful. Well, it isn't. Mean-spirited men being encouraged. You know, you're a wonderful person. Miserable sods. Or the death watch. How often do we see this? The lodges are controlled by this unspoken attitude of grumpiness, and everybody's waiting for the grumpiest to die. That's the way you want to be remembered. Well, if you are of that state of mind, the rest of the world is mocking you. You better be making a sizable contribution somehow to compensate for that kind of disgraceful existence. There is no overt evidence of any form of utopian vision in the world of the medieval operative Mason. In that world, the mystical reward was the outcome of work, and it is presumed for those working on religious projects, the joy of serving God and the prospect of a pathway to heaven. The first historical reference to Freemasonry occurs in 1376, 14th century. Huh? We'll have to play a little music from that period just a little later in the show. Just give us that vibe. And it occurred, the first historical reference to Freemasonry was with the mention of John Wycliffe, and with the mention of Thomas Reck and John Lesneys as Freemasons in the city of London. And later in 1383, John Wycliffe refers to men of subtle craft as Freemasons and others. Up to that point, or more probably up to the arrival of the Black Death in 1348-49, workers in stone had gloried in a variety of trade-specific titles. Cementarius was a trained and skilled layer of building blocks. A Mockling was a builder of garden terrace walls. A Biandore was a hand basket carrier. A Lathamus was a skilled worker, probably some sort of Manassian, or prefect, or overseer. The Majores Lathomi were in charge of projects. Muratori specialized in walls, and so on. A team of operative masons, or lodge, might be able to cover up to 20 different skills, or to be able to buy in a particular skill, such as that of the alabasterer, if a particular piece of alabaster carving had to be done. In 1435, the word Freemason had come into wider use, and a distinction was being drawn between the skilled men and the untrained, or at least unattached cowboys or Machens, the Cowans, that Tyler is employed to guard against. In those early days, the Tyler's principal duty was to prevent any unqualified Machen gaining trade secrets by eavesdropping on lodge meetings. Essentially, the Tyler, or Outer Guard, was a form of counter-espionage. As timber frame buildings replaced traditional stone-built dwellings, and the demand for castles, abbeys, and monasteries decreased, so operative masonry went into a decline. It did not disappear completely. There were still civic buildings to build, town and city walls to repair or extend, bridges to build or restore after flooding, stone floors, courtyards, and fireplaces to create. But operative masonry was no longer the second major employer of labor. The concept of a happy nowhere played no part in the philosophical and theological debates at the time at any level of society. Medieval philosophers discussed the link between faith and reason, the existence and simplicity of God, the purpose of philosophy and metaphysics, and problems of knowledge, of universals, and the individuation. There was one but happy place, and that was heaven. Most thinkers followed St. Augustine when he said that he would never allow his philosophical investigations to go beyond the authority of God. For over 1,000 years, his views shaped man's approach to all the philosophical inquiries. Paradoxically, one fundamental aspect of this debate did relate to the later development of speculative masonry. Hylomorphism began to figure in philosophical discussion in the end of the 12th century. Theorists, among them St. Augustine, who argued that primordial matter was the first cause of the universe, led an attempt to explain the relationship between matter and form. The argument presumed that primordial matter was the most perfect and complete form of indeterminateness. God, the supreme being, was determined to be the most perfect form of determinateness, the highest and most complete form of reality. It was, or had been, God's work to impart actuality and usefulness to primordial matter. This, in turn, prompted the idea that things are a compound of substance and shape. In simple terms, a statue was deemed to be a compound of its base material and the form sculpted from it. This simplified explanation acknowledges but ignores what Aristotle held to be the four basic principles of being. For Aristotle, being was about matter and form. Something to be, Aristotle argued, for the existence of four causes. The material cause of being was the material form which the statue was sculpted. The formal cause was the idea in the sculptor's mind. The efficient cause was the agent of creation, the sculptor. And the final cause was the purpose for which the statue was made. Money or status. It was this type of Aristotelian logic that led hylomorphic thinkers to ponder the mysteries of the achievements of the medieval operatives. Hylomorphous thinkers began to wonder how it was that cold, inanimate stone, created in that form by the intelligence and skill of the supreme being, could be fashioned into such marvelous testimonies of faith. They concluded that while God had worked through the hands of stonemasons, there was, even so, something intrinsically special about stone that allowed it to respond to the efforts of man in such a splendid manner. It was this line of thought that prompted a progression from the idea that God was working through the hand of the operative mason to a consideration of the tools he employed that ultimately gave a symbolic meaning to the working tools. From the explanations of those working tools, with their emphasis upon personal conduct and development, emerges the pathway to a Masonic utopia. Had an operative mason in 1340 been concerned with such abstract matters as utopia, he might have constructed a society closely resembling the world of the operative lodge. Masons were bound to their lodge as free men. They worked at their chosen skills to the glory of God. They were under no work or service obligations to some distant lord. They could sell their skills or any produce they might raise from a piece of land. They could hold public office, give evidence in civil or criminal cases, set up their children in a trade, and allow them to marry for love. The individual might seek education for himself or his family. Perhaps most important of all, he could move about without let or hindrance. Didn't need permission, eh? The obligations to his lodge and the requirements laid upon him as he discharged his duties, embodied in what are now called the ancient charges, were essentially the rules and conditions under which he worked. They must have seemed no more onerous than the guarantee of employment. The lodge was an ordered and disciplined society as any abbey or community of monks, and doubtless as much a prey or personal tensions and anxieties as any Browning imagined in his soliloquy of the Spanish cloister, which I recommend. That's Robert Browning, New Oxford Book of Victorian Verse. Do I have that here? I do. My gosh. Life may not have been soft or easy, but the Mason was among fellows he could trust, who lived by the codes he respected and seldom had to fear for either his food or his wage. Whatever infighting occurred between contracts, their delivery, and the details of the project happened above his level of concern. So you see, there was conflict. But he could go, you could go, I could go, and be with fellows that he trusted. He could see and take pride in the fruits of his labors. Beliefs about the possibility of achieving an utopian society or some form of an almost utopian social structure began to take a more clearly defined shape during the Age of Enlightenment, as perceptive observers noted, and began to ponder the customs of native peoples they encountered. From those observations and musings, they began to weave the myth of the noble savage. During his service in North America with Montcalm in the 1750s, Bougainville developed an admiration for the social fabric of the people of the Longhouse, the five tribes of the Mohawks, the Oneidas, Senecas, Onondagas, and Cayugas. Under no illusions about their fundamental savagery, he admired their democratic form of organization. The absence of any form of formal state apparatus and the virtual gender-free character of their society. As a European accustomed to the paraphernalia of cumbersome state machinery, he marveled at a society without a state or communal economic system that functioned without coercion within a framework of remarkable political sophistication. There is no record of his having observed any form of peer group criticism or social disapproval that is known to have existed among other primitive peoples. In the 1760s, while serving as a naval officer, he explored the islands of the Pacific and found among the islanders a not dissimilar world that was to lay the foundations for the enduring myth of the noble savage. These ideas certainly became the talk of the French court and beyond. Charles Fourier, born in 1772 and he died in 1837, created a world in which all passions were deemed to be God-given and therefore to be cherished and indulged. To allow the complete array of human passions to range freely and completely toward their total realization and self-fulfillment, a complicated system of checks and balances, meetings and monitors was to be established. These systems would seek to match taste with taste, inclination with inclination, until the world revolved in harmony, with no person feeling excluded, no passion left unstated. Fourier's theory was based upon an assumption that civilized society creates its own evils by stifling passions deemed to be uncivilized. Such evils could be resolved by placing individuals in situations where their God-given inclinations can be given free rein. In this way, the two-thirds of male children whom he presumed enjoy playing in filth would be employed as latrine or street cleaners. Those with bloodthirsty tendencies would become slaughtermen, and so forth. In this way, a world would be created where human activity would begin in order, be conducted in peace, and culminate in harmony, an almost Masonic vision. What it lacked was any form of personal challenge or development. The emphasis was wholly upon personal gratification, with scant thought given to how the initial identifications were to be carried out. People would in some way gravitate toward those areas of life and work within the community where they felt most comfortable. And so a utopian society based on harmony would prevail. Flawed though his argument undoubtedly was, Fourier is inching toward the notion of an idealized society in which there is an early echo of Freemasonry. He would have been very comfortable with the words, "May our labors thus begun in order be conducted in peace and closed in harmony." For that was what his utopia was intended to deliver. From a Masonic standpoint, a key document called New Atlantis had appeared in 1627. And it was written by Francis Bacon. An early science fiction novel sets out to show how science will transform the world. Science is the major intellectual enterprise of the Bensalemites, who are presently an exemplary citizens, are about devout Christians, heterosexual, and much given to ritual and ceremony. And we question, is this the first Freemason? So there's my indulgence today. There's my indulgence. This material, you'll find quotes from Francis Bacon and Beecher and Bienvenue and Browning and Rousseau on the discourse of science and the arts. It's a myth that has genesis in two places. Anyway, check, you can look for that. But this is some of the research that was presented by Brother Rogers, Michael Rogers. And we'll find his work not that obscure, not that obscure. But he started with reference to Thomas More's Utopia. Okay. So when you're looking for some explanation. So Utopia was written in 1516. Yeah. The ideas that were influential in the day influenced the thinking and development of Freemasonry. Freemasonry, as we heard here, reminded here, is not the structure and the political nature or the Constitution. Freemasonry is you. Freemasonry exists. So in an upcoming show, I'm going to be talking about Masonry from the perspective after we have all died. I wanted to talk to you about how we will look after we're dead and what we want to achieve, and what we will have achieved. Will we be judged as forthright and capable men known for committing and accomplishing? Or will we be known as the men of rhetoric that did all of their planning in their minds and could, where they could move mountains and applied so very little to their world around them? Let's see how it looks. Thanks for the indulgence, though. I think it was served a purpose. Now, just a little bit of a break. For goodness sakes, you know. Those of you this time of year, you know, we're the 7th of December. These are people that are, Sagittarius is quite prevalent. I like this little poem. Who loves the dim religious light, who always keeps a star in sight. An optimist, both gay and bright, it is the Sagittarius. Remember Sagittarius, it's like that half horse, half man with the bow. At the heart of the Sagittarian lore stands the centaur, Chiron. And this is a figure of philosopher and teacher within Greek mythology. And Chiron personifies the very soul of Sagittarius, the philosopher and teacher. The half man, half horse portrays the conflict between the philosophical mind and the carnal instinct of human nature. It's an interesting glyph. Have you seen it? The glyph represents an arrow slung in a bow aiming at the stars. This symbol corresponds with the Sagittarian ideals of cosmic progress and abundance. The ruler of Sagittarius is Jupiter. So we generally know Sagittarians are positive people, a bright outlook in life, enterprising, full of energy and vitality, ambitious and optimistic. Nothing seems to get them down. Good. Good. So that's this time of year. And we're coming up very shortly to the Capricorns, aren't we? Jesus was the Capricorn. Yeah. Wonder what else we had going on. It's a beautiful time of year. I hope you're celebrating and are planning to celebrate it in your own private manner, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. That's Alfred Lord Tennyson. Don't necessarily apply these great ideas to everything muscular and combative. It's the privacy of your thought. Guard your roving thoughts, says Tennyson, with a jealous care, for speech is but the dialer of the thoughts, and every fool can plainly read in your words what is the hour of your thoughts. No man ever got high by pulling down other people. The intelligent merchant does not knock his competitors. The sensible worker does not work with those who work with him. Don't knock your friends. Don't knock your enemies. And don't knock yourself. I like that. All experience is an arch through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. Particular tip of the hat to all of our brethren associated with the York Rite for that one. And out of darkness came the hands that reached through nature molding men. A lie which is half a truth is ever the blackest of lies. Thank you, Lord Alfred Lord Tennyson. So a tune. How about something? You okay with something of the period? A little bit of Renaissance, 16th century? That would do, I think. Yeah, I think that would do very nicely. Here's a little piece, probably around, this is, my goodness, this is 14th century stuff. I think you'll like this. It's called the Cantiones. It's a medieval Christmas tune. Very short. On the birthday of the highest king, each one, whether you sing or recite, rejoice with all joy. Wonderful remain, oh, wonderful remain, oh.
condado de Puebla, nuevo Riga, nueva terra, nuevo vostra casa. Tribus son y prisa y de una pregunta de ti.
Papa de Pinero, Papa de
Pinero. Profetía Daniel, promisum pecabrine, contra tu divino. Dice la misrele, pues monfeti de mano.
Moving on, this is 16th century German. See, listen to the difference. Listen, it's not so stark. Christmas songs. Back before in the day, when we would go to, when we finally had entertainment, we would gather probably in a pub or a public house. And we're necessarily drinking establishments, but places where you could get a bowl of something hot and perhaps a bit of mead or a bit of cider or a bit of beer. And of course, like people everywhere, they getting together and in front of a fire where we can be comfortable and relax, we would begin to sing. Singing was good for the miners from Roman times, mining going on. The Welsh made it something that we respect to this very day. It was a way of clearing the lungs after a whole day's work in the mines. Here you'll hear a little bit of, this is a very, very old Christmas song you've heard a number of times. It's called, we know it as Old Christmas Tree, but it's an old traditional way of singing.
Thank you.
old tunes. Eh? This is Gregorian Christmas chant. Has moved on. The chant accompanied by a very powerful organ. And to keep up with the volume, the choirs are larger. And instead of, we're still using playing with tone, but now it's tone layered on tone. Holidays are coming up, so I'm going to leave you now. Thank you for joining me on Sonic Companion. It's been really great to have you. I look forward to seeing you next week. We'll get together and do some things Masonic. In the meantime, keep committing those acts of Masonic kindness. Cheers.